This episode is brought to you by Active Digital, connecting digital transformation to customer experience. Learn more at activedigital.com.
I've seen what happens when people who look at you sideways suddenly begin to understand how you operate and how they can operate similarly and create solutions to wicked problems. And to me, that's what is the secret sauce of design thinking.
Does design thinking work? We're here today with Steve Nedvedek to talk about that, and let's get into it now. Do you want to decommoditize your products and services? Do you want to become a destination brand, increase your revenue, and have more control over your pricing? You're in the right place. Each week, we'll talk about how to create great customer experiences and how to orient your company to enable them. We're your hosts, Devin and David, and this is the Experience Leader Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. I am really excited to have a man who I now get to call a friend, Steve Nedvedek, back on the show. Steve, how are you doing, man?
I'm great, Devin. Man, enjoying things, trying to stay safe and healthy and being very busy. So all is well for the moment.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I'm very thankful for you being willing to come back on. There was all kinds of stuff that I wanted to get into last time, but time did not allow for that. So I'm appreciative of you being generous because there's so much more wisdom to glean. I think we got a pretty hot topic to talk about today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having me back on. There's plenty to talk about in this area for sure.
Oh, yeah. So today we're talking about, does design thinking work? You know, I encountered an article by a prominent designer at a big company, and he was basically critiquing the effectiveness of design thinking. And what I gathered from his piece was that design thinking oversimplified what design is and essentially misrepresented what it is to the business world. And it was kind of like a case for design thinking trying to replace design. And my experience with this hasn't been that. You know, I've been a consultant for a while and I was in the agency world before I was in the consulting world. And I saw a marked shift in my encounters with folks that primarily had a business management background. I saw a shift, especially within the last 5 to 7 years of encountering people who had some exposure to design thinking. And I can say unequivocally that my experiences working with those folks were better. We were able to speak some of the same language because we were able to come at problems from a human-centered point of view. And that was something that was not very common prior to that. And I'm not trying to say it's super common now. I think there's still a lot of work to be done, but it's been a net positive for me. So I was kind of taken aback at this guy's take on design thinking. And for folks who don't know, Steve is a professor. He actually teaches design thinking at Wake Forest. He is responsible for spreading design thinking at Chick-fil-A, and it's become a big part of the culture there. And him actually being a designer, I feel like Steve's got a good amount of experience and authority to be able to speak on what the net effect here is of design thinking. So I'd love to get your take on that, Steve.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've run across articles like that before. I've also run across people who say things like, it's more important to have design doing than it is design thinking, as though it's some kind of badge that you're supposed to really, if you're a true believer, you really, you know, that's where your head needs to be. So I'm going to come at this from a little bit different angle. I'm going to come at this from the angle of the kid who was highly creative, who was the artsy, craftsy kid in high school, cartooned for the school newspaper, did a lot of cartooning, a lot of designing, a lot of creating of things. and trying to explain to people what it is that I do. Because once I got into the world of business, complete with my master's in theater degree, found myself at a corporation, Chick-fil-A, and oftentimes felt like a fish out of water, where I got the sense that people would look at me and not understand what it is I did or how I thought. And I would have people tell me all the time, man, I don't know how you do it, but I sure do love the way you think. Design thinking for me, had I known then what I know now, I would have been able to clearly articulate, use the word language, Devin. I think that is a perfect, perfect word for design thinking. It is a language to be able to communicate what is going on and the process that you're using with people who don't understand how you do what you do. I married an accountant. She is wonderful. I love her to death. And I have no idea how she does what she does. You know, we are a great two sides of the coin in our family. She takes care of a very certain side of our family operations, and I take care of another side of our family operations. She told me when we first got married that if you take care of Halloween and all the school projects for the kids, I'll do all the books for the family. Well, my Halloween and school projects for the kids, I thought it was a good deal. Halloween and school projects for the kids have been long gone for me. She's still doing the books for the family, and she does them quite well, which is one of the reasons I was able to retire early. So to me, if you define design thinking as a new way, a different model, if you start to think about it in a certain sense, maybe I understand this author's point, but I don't think about it in a sense other than it's a language for me to put process behind what I do when I create. And I can speak that language to people who are business people who don't create from an artistic sense, and I can have common conversation with them. So does it work? Oh, absolutely it works. It works because I've seen it work. It works because it has enabled me to have the ability to connect with people who aren't like me, to have people understand me better, where my brain is on certain things. But it also works because I've seen the outcomes of it. I've seen what happens when people who look at you sideways suddenly begin to understand how you operate and how they can operate similarly and create solutions to wicked problems. And to me, that's what is the secret sauce of design thinking. It's a disciplined mindset and process that reflects how I've grown up as the creative weird kid. And like I said, if I'd had this decades ago, I think I would have had more people understand me than try to run away in fear. Screaming. What is he doing?
I love that. I love that description. I mean, a lot of what you said there, just man after my own heart. It was the same for me in high school. And when I encountered design thinking for the first time, because I hadn't heard of it until I'd gotten to a certain point in my career. And when I saw the process, I just understood that as the way you did things.
That makes plenty of sense. I mean, even now as being retired and just working on things around the house, just little things that need to be done, need to be fixed. We installed new vanity in our bathroom 2 days ago. There was a lot I didn't understand about what needed to be done when this thing went in. I thought I was doing the right thing. I thought I was ordering some things correctly. I didn't. I had to do workarounds. I had to get in there and fix things. I had to get in there. I mean, it would have been real easy for me to send it back, and I almost did. But I was like, no, I can do this. And I broke down the problem into the different phases that I know my brain works, and I tackled it one step at a time. And to me, if design thinking does nothing else, it calls us to to stop just throwing mud against a wall and calls us to think a little bit deeper about the order of things. There are certain things you must do first before you do the next thing. And as a kid, oftentimes I'd get into trouble on my projects because I didn't understand that. I didn't understand, oh, I need to do this piece first. And like my dad, who is a portrait painter, always used to say, start with your dark colors first. Now, yeah, from a technique standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. But from a design thinking standpoint, there's a piece of that where you go, oh, I have to understand how the paint works.
Yes.
It's not just I can paint a picture. I have to understand how the paint works. And so for me, design thinking is a great way of adjusting my brain into the discipline of knowing what comes next.
I think that's fantastic. And I think that it's extremely helpful that it allows us, you know, to have that shared language around the process, around what comes first, what comes next, what is the order that you do things in, and to even take a step back, just to wrap your mind around the reason we're doing this is to solve a problem for a person. That's huge. It's a paradigm shift. And I can tell you, I've done a lot of projects where that was a paradigm shift that I had to do for the client and for the folks in the room or on the project with me. That's a paradigm shift that I had to do. And sometimes that's time spent, right? That's time spent to do that paradigm shift. I feel like people who have encountered design thinking, we don't have to start at square one. We can start solving the problem. We can start understanding, which, you know, the beginning of solving a problem is understanding the humans for whom you're solving it. But when you're starting at square one, you have to say, hey, I know that you guys are focused on this target, this objective. I know that you're focused on this one thing. Let's take a moment, take a step back and reframe this around, who are we solving this for? Let's understand them. Let's understand how we solve this in a way that they say, this is extremely helpful. They get me. They understand me. And we all love it when people do that for us. And so I look at it that way. And that's something that, in my opinion, there's a understanding, a basis of understanding that started to be built by this movement of design thinking that I think that it wouldn't be there. We wouldn't be able to start there. And I think it's fundamentally good. That's the other thing I need to add. I think that is a fundamentally good way to look at doing our work in the business world.
Yeah. And if you go back, you know, we've all heard these stories about how products used to be created, you know, and the large companies who had an idea and then just created something and then was able to sell it to the general public through, you know, advertising. I mean, the Mad Men scenarios, you know, these are not scenarios that are starting with consumer, customer-centric empathy. They're starting with a product. Somebody created something. Now they got to sell it. It's very different from where we are today. And it's very different from, you know, the customer centricness of, like, for example, a company like Chick-fil-A, which is where we always were thinking about what does the customer need? What do they want? What are they going to be willing to do? What's the compromise for them? So starting with them first versus starting with just whatever the product is. Well, we got a widget. Here's a widget. Now we're going to sell it. Oh, we got to advertise it. So let's get on the Ed Sullivan Show and advertise our widget. And then we'll sell it. Doesn't work that way anymore. Life is not like that anymore. We are so specific now on our needs. And advertisers now have to get way, way down granular about what their customers want and how they react and who they are. It used not to be that way when you had three television stations in the country and that was it and that was all. It's crazy. It's crazy how specific it's gotten. It's crazy how splintered it's become. And as a result, if you don't pay attention to the audience you're trying to reach and design for them, you don't have a snowball's chance. You're not living in the 50s. And I'm glad for that. I really am, because now we have a lot more choice. And we have a lot more opportunities to get products that are meaningful to us. And what's meaningful to me is not going to be meaningful to you necessarily. But the days of just relying on advertising to push the widget are long gone. And for me, when you begin to understand that the customer and the empathy piece comes first and must come first, as a business person, that makes sense. I don't think that that is still taught the way it needs to be taught to upcoming entrepreneurs today. They still may be asked the question, what's the business you want to start? I think the better question is, what's the problem you want to solve?
Absolutely. Yes. Man, you need to say that one more time for the people in the back. Man, that is dang right. I have encountered too much folks deciding to go into business because something looked good on paper, right? It looked good on paper, but they had their thinking didn't have enough of a connection to the problem they were trying to solve in the market. And again, I think design thinking puts you in the frame of mind that you go into it thinking that. It's how you solve the problem. It's how you form an offering, how you form a product. In my opinion, you know, that's why jobs to be done and design thinking are really my operating system for how I solve any business problem, because it gives you, in my opinion, they give you everything. It gives you what the product should be, what the surrounding customer experience should be, what the marketing language should be. And it's all designed around an understanding of the customer.
Yeah. And it gives you the freedom to fail at trying and iterating different ways that this thing can come to life. You don't start with the completed product. You start with the need. And the need generates your path. And I tell students this all the time. Design thinking is not an equation. It is a structure. But it's not an equation. If it were an equation, we'd be able to plug our figures in there and get outcomes that we're sure of, and everybody would make $1 billion, and everybody would be right all the time, and everybody would get what they wanted, and everybody. But it's not that. It is more of a method of training your brain to take the next step. And that's hard. That's really hard for a lot of business people because it's frustrating, especially for those business people who are wired as ideators who don't have time for or naturally avoid. And I'm this way. I mean, I get it because I'm wired this way. I want to go. I want to get something done. I want to start. I want to make. Don't tell me about the information. Don't tell me about the data. Look, I trust myself. I trust my gut. Let's go. A lot of leaders, Devin, are like that, especially leaders of nonprofits, especially leaders in the church world, you'd come to believe, are like that. And it's hard for the people that have to actually do the work to pull the reins back on them and go, be patient. We're not ready to do that yet. You haven't thought of everything yet. What's the problem we're trying to solve? Not what's the idea you've got in your head. What's the problem you're trying to solve? And that's very, very difficult for people who are wired to activate, and they're wired to ideate, and they're wired to inspire with vision. And I'm a person like that, but God knows I need grounding in reality and facts and figures, and thank God I married an accountant. And not just any accountant.
That is right, man. I'm the same way. It's amazing that you describe it that way, because I am the same way, and it forces me to slow down. It forces me to think about more of the detail. It actually makes space, in my opinion, for people on the team who are more detailed thinkers to be able to poke holes, to be able to challenge. It's not saying that we have to think of everything up front. One of the big parts of design thinking is the iterative process of thinking through something, trying to understand the problem, coming up with a hypothesis in a prototype, right? And then going and testing it and seeing if it works, and going and iterating on what didn't work and doubling down on the stuff that did work.
or being smart enough to try multiple things all during that time, where you pit one thing against another. You know, putting all your eggs in the basket of a prototype is really dicey unless you have multiple prototypes going at it to try to see which is the best to solve the problem. I mean, we've been through a season of COVID now, and if we can all rewind the clock back to 2 years ago, once vaccines started to be developed, you saw the race between the different vaccine providers. Which one was going to actually solve the problem? Which one was going to be better? You're going to get Moderna, you're going to get Pfizer, you're going to get AstraZeneca, you're going to go, you know, which way, Johnson & Johnson, which way are you going to go? And that's as it should be. That's the way it's supposed to be, because people are coming at it from different directives and different perspectives, and they're coming up with different solutions. And then you say, okay, put up or shut up. And let's see which one of these actually is going to work best for us. So I love when that happens. Part of our problem and our challenge is we don't live in a world that allows us the opportunity to just try things. We live in a world that demands immediate satisfaction, where we can't spend the time to fix stuff. We can't spend the time to rethink or reframe, as you said. Reframe is such a beautiful word. Man, if we had somebody run for president that said, my platform for the next 4 years is I'm going to just fix the things that are broken, and we're going to start with some of our documents, and we're going to start with some of our processes and some of our systems, I'd be all ears. But we don't act that way. We just slap a slogan on a t-shirt and off to the races. How in the world can you manage and lead a country of hundreds of millions of people without understanding the problems and really trying to fix the infrastructure of the way that it's supposed to work, and making sure that you're staying on process? We just don't do that. We don't have time for that. And that doesn't win elections, you know? It's sad.
Well, you know, what's amazing is people are told it doesn't win elections. I think if there was somebody who actually wanted to do that and didn't just always listen to the political consultants, that maybe they'd just zig when everybody else is zagging and win.
They'd have my ear, I tell you that. But there's so much of life is not like that. They want the immediacy of our world drives what I think is a poor or a bad reaction to the necessary discipline of design thinking, because people want their results so quickly. We don't have time to do it right.
The saying that I first heard in the advertising world, which, you know, deadlines are way shorter than any other job that I've ever experienced. The only deadlines that I've seen that were shorter were in my wife's job in TV production. 5 years feels like 10 years in advertising. But the saying was, there's never enough time to do it right, but there's always enough time to do it over.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not to say you can get it right on the first try, but let's actually think. Let's actually take the time to think through this and not just throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. And I think that the desire for results, the problem, I think, is it comes down to the greatest desire being the personal results as opposed to actually solving the problem for the person. The person wants the reward, right? They're not in love with solving the problem for the customer, for making the customer's life better. That's what I think that the people who are great at solving the problem, I'll set aside making the most money, even though I think those things are correlated. Otherwise, I wouldn't have started this podcast. But just doing better at solving the problem comes from really caring about the person, really caring about the problem. And that changes what you're willing to do. That changes how far you're willing to go, how long you're willing to wait, how many things you're willing to try.
And what perhaps people are willing to put up with in the pursuit of finding the best solution. Notice I didn't say right or wrong solution. We moralize way too much on things like that. Well, that was the right call. Let's use words like right and wrong for moral things is kind of my way of thinking. Good, better, best. If I'm searching for best, I need to be able to do some things that are going to be required maybe than if I'm just searching for good. And the way that some of our systems are set up right now is, especially if you're working for a publicly held company, you're talking about shareholder value every quarter, and you got to see that go up. I was very fortunate in Chick-fil-A to be working for a private company where Truett Cathy knew that if he listened to customers and if he took the long view, if he played the long game, not the short game, if he played the long game, he was going to win. And the long game means that you don't necessarily have the answer in the moment, but you have to think about it before it becomes a problem. And the long game means that you don't not do things because, oh, they don't make any money. The long game means that you invest in things that may be a loss leader, but they're for the right reason. Case in point, and I love this example. When I was heading up the Chick-fil-A Kids Meal program at Chick-fil-A, we would oftentimes see young families, you know, with their kids in the restaurants, and the child would have a kids meal in front of them. And, you know. And the parents, if you're watching them, okay, if you just go to empathetic listening and just watching the actions of your customers, we'd see these young parents grab this bag, this Chick-fil-A kids meal bag, and tear it open and create a paper surface for which the kid could then eat the nuggets and the fries. I mean, we've all seen it. And if we've got little kids, we've all probably done it, right? We open up the bag or flatten the bag and you make a little placemat. And so we started having this conversation about what if we provided for parents this adhesive component that can go on the table that's a nice, clean, sterile mat that children can eat from. I mean, love Chick-fil-A for so many reasons, but one of the reasons that in that particular instance is that was a cost associated with that. I mean, those things aren't free. Chick-fil-A operators pay for those. The franchisees spend money on those. Customers don't pay for those. They're not like a nickel or a quarter, whatever. You get them. And the reason behind it was the right reason for the customer. It solved the problem. And so while there was a cost associated with it, the long game was that family was going to come eat with you more often because you were doing right by them. And I've seen Chick-fil-A operators put little Cheerios and cups with lids on them for little toddlers who are learning how to eat finger food. That costs the operator something. They're not charging for that. You know, so if we are in a system where we're working off of only profits and what's next for the corporate P&L for this particular quarter and returning shareholder value, we're going to miss out on solving problems for customers that are really important that can get us where we need to be in the long game. And design thinking is the structure on which the long game hangs. If that makes sense.
Absolutely makes sense. And I think that I've talked with many a business person recently about that, about the struggle with that, about being beholden to producing growth at a certain clip and that causing a company to make decisions that are not in the best interest of the customer. And I hope that we can get past that. You know, I think that we have a great market system that allows people to participate in the market in a lot of different ways, but we can't make money the ultimate answer to all questions. Money is a byproduct. It is a reward for providing value. I've encountered folks that place providing shareholder value above all else. And again, shareholder value comes from providing value to the customer. That's the outcome. If you continue to provide value, shareholder value is going to go up. The short-term thinking is a problem. It's a problem, not just in that sense. It's a problem on down the chain, because when you think about certain incentives that people have within a company, people can chase the bonus instead of chasing what's right for the company. And what's right for the company is generally what's right for the customer. You don't get to have a company if you don't have a customer. So that's the rub that I see there. You know, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, you know, do you feel like design thinking ever tried to replace the designer? That was another thing that I feel like was introduced in this piece by this designer that I never encountered that, but you know, your experience is wider ranging than mine, I believe. And I'd love to hear your take on that.
I don't think that it does. I don't think that it should. I can see where when you learn to speak a language or when you're taking English in, you know, in ninth grade and you learn all the rules, you learn I before E except after C and all this stuff, you know, when to use a semicolon and when to not, when to use a hyphen, blah, 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 blah. And kind of the way that they position it is, well, we got to learn these things first because that's the basis and that's foundation. But then when you start doing a lot of that, you can step away if you want to because you're smarter or something. You're a senior now. Or whatever, you're starting sentences with and or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And so I get that. Well, I mean, logically, I get that. And I think from a design thinking standpoint, I mean, I can see where a designer would go, well, you're putting a structure on me, which I've grown out of. You're putting a structure on me that doesn't allow me the freedom to be able to do what I want to do and how I want to do it. And this is what works for me. So, I mean, I can see how somebody who designs day in and day out for a living might interpret that. But from my perspective, design thinking was not created for the designer. It was created for the non-designer. And so we have laws for people who break the laws, not for the people who obey the laws. You know? That's right. And so for me, it's kind of like if it's helping me to explain to the non-designer why it's important, then I as a designer should be able to just suck it up a little bit and go, okay, this will actually help me in the long run because I'll get more people on my side and I'll get more people to engage and trust me because they see the wisdom in this methodology that I'm espousing. And the other good thing too is, I mean, designers aren't perfect and we screw up all the time. And there are times we go, oh, that's a great idea. We just do it. And we forget. Yeah, maybe we missed a step. We forget. Maybe we didn't prototype as much as we did. Several times at Chick-fil-A, people would have an idea for a product. Slam dunk. Oh, we should do this. Slam dunk. Let's do it tomorrow. And everybody goes, rah, 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 rah. And then here comes our friends, the research folks, you know, and they say, well, wait, hang on. Let's test it first. Well, no, it's a slam dunk. Don't you understand? And so we all back up and we, you know, we give deference to our research folks, our research partners. And it turns out a lot of times they were right to force us to test because the things that we thought were a slam dunk were not a slam dunk. And the things that popped up as a result of it actually being in the customer's hands were not the way that it was intended to be used or was not the way we learned something. Imagine that. Imagine that. And then we wound up not rolling it out, which was great. Because if we had, I mean, the most money that you spend in the design thinking process is in launch. And if you go from imagine to launch, you go from imagine, which is a portion where you're not spending an awful lot of money, to launch where you're spending a gazillion dollars. Who wants to mess up launch? Not me. And then it's eggs on everybody's faces. It's just not a good plan.
Right. I think what you hit on was I definitely detected some of the, you know, this particular designer feeling like there was this oversimplified or over-specified process that was being.
Yeah, you're putting a straitjacket on me. Stop. You know, I'm above that. I don't need that.
Right. It was kind of like, hey, you know, this particular problem may not call for this exact process. I'm not convinced that design thinking is so restrictive. Again, I look at the process and I think to myself, anytime I've ever made anything, I wound up following this process, whether I wanted to or not, because it's just the way that the world works because we're not psychic. We don't know all of the answers ahead of time. So I make something, I try to use it, I realize that I didn't make this in the best way, or this is, you know, this part of it is very inefficient, or this is pretty annoying. And so I go back and I adjust it. And then I try, you know, I try to see how it works again. I've done that with code. I've done that with physical things. I've anything that I'm trying to build or create. That's the process. And so I think of design thinking as really just adding a form to that process of iteration that we're forced to go through because we're not all geniuses.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's the skeleton. I mean, and without the form, you know, we're sausage fingers, you know, we're just this blob of jelly. You know, we have to have the form inside of this thing in order for us to actually be able to do meaningful things and to make movement and to create. And so I find that it's also kind of maybe more popular now to kind of push aside design thinking a little bit in favor of other things. You know, well, you know, that's rudimentary. And you know, I had one fellow come up to me one time in my career at Chick-fil-A, and he was somebody that hadn't been in any of the design thinking classes I've taught, but he cornered me at lunch or break room or something, said, "Hey, Steve, got a question for you. I really feel like I would provide a lot of value to my team if I could become a scrum master." And there was like silence from me. I just want to be a scrum master and it will provide value to my team. And I thought, you don't even understand how the generic thing works, but your desire is to be a very specific, you know, it's like you're looking at the trees, you're forgetting there's a forest out there. And while you might provide value as a scrum master, I would encourage you to learn the language first. There's a big push in certain areas for people to go to agile and do different kinds of things and say, oh, this is not, you know, design thinking is older, it doesn't work or whatever. Let's do this. Well, I mean, my understanding from a friend of mine who teaches at Stanford, who was one of the fathers of design thinking, is that agile was created in Silicon Valley for people who were writing code to be able to prototype faster because they were spending too much time perfecting a prototype. So Agile gave them an opportunity to toggle back and forth between prototyping and imagining and understanding. And it was more like, which is great. I get it. But not everything needs to do that. Works great for digital platforms, might work great for some other things. And I guess what I'm saying is, I'm not saying those things aren't important. Everything has a place and everything is a component under, you know, a larger whole. But I think the umbrella idea here with the design thinking gives is it allows you to dig deep into the different components of it and come up with certain practices that help. When you think about empathetic listening, when you think about the front end, you're thinking about understanding, you know, Warren Berger, a friend of mine who wrote a great book called Glimmer and A More Beautiful Question. And, you know, he's one of the leaders in curiosity and asking questions and understanding. There's all kinds of leaders in the imagine field when you get to ideation, but there aren't a lot of people who spend time thinking about the right questions to ask on the front end. Michael Schrag, another contact from back in my Chick-fil-A days, used to be really, really big on prototyping and coming up with the right process for prototyping, you know, and so people become experts in different areas of it. It's all needed. It's all necessary. It's fun to break out a certain, you know, a certain component of it and work on that. But to throw the whole thing away and go, yeah, no, we're going to go do this now, to me is a huge error in the fundamental methodology that your brain needs to go through as you step through the pieces of solving a problem. You really cannot just imagine launch. You really cannot successfully make the researchers go away so you don't understand problems. You really cannot validate in front of customers the way you need. I mean, if anybody ever wants to hear a great story about that, I encourage them to just read up on how Segway was developed. That story is classic on the methodology that you use, and when you skip a step or you miss a step or you don't put the amount of time in that step, bad things happen. They really do.
Lots of money gets wasted. I've been the guy with egg on my face for not doing enough work on the front end, and nobody likes it. And that can cost money that's not yours. That's another thing that I think people have to think about. Yes, there's a place for risk, but risk doesn't have to be blind. It doesn't have to be foolish. You said something that I think that is important. You talked about, you know, that person that said they wanted to be a scrum master. And listeners of the show may know that, you know, I've got strong opinions about this, but I agree. I don't think that design works in the Scrum framework. Agile and Scrum even are not the same thing. Agile is basically a philosophy of development. Scrum is a very prescriptive way of doing work that has rituals that are supposed to be followed and are not to be violated, even by folks that are higher up in rank, et cetera. And I'm not saying that all of these things are bad, but I am saying that my experience and understanding of Scrum, having worked in software development, it was not made with the process of answering the early big questions in mind. It was not created for that. It was created for software developers. It was created when you have a much higher level of definition of the problem and a much higher definition of what the higher level of fidelity in understanding what the solution is. I don't think that it's great at taking a step back and asking the right or the best questions, right? It's not made for that. And when you get into the Scrum process, it's a machine that's going. It is designed to go. And when you try to tell the machine to stop, you have to have a very, very good reason to tell the machine to stop. And when you're in the early stages, you can't assume that you can plug a couple of low fidelity answers into the machine and expect to get a good solution out of that that's actually going to solve somebody's problem. And so I think that we wanted to try to cram everything into this very prescriptive way of working so that we could make it all fit in a nice little package. And I do think that we get to a nice package. It's just that the square peg does not fit into the round hole. The square peg still has the hard edges on it. You don't get to the round hole until you've done some refinement. You know what this thing is, you know, to give it an analogy.
No, and you know, what you're talking about is you can become so tied to structure and process, regardless of what you're following, that you're not thinking straight. And that's where I think in general terms, when you have a good understanding and a good base and a good foundation, and you know when to hold those things loosely, there are folks that can't get out of the understand stage because they always feel like, I need more information. There's something else I got to know. Don't know this. I got to think this. What about this? And then the wringing of the hand starts, and then the analysis paralysis starts. And you get tied to that so that you really can't move and you can't take the next step. And I think the important thing is to make sure that while we're talking about structure, while we're talking about process, while we're talking about methodology, and while we're talking about just the way that your brain works when you're thinking about design thinking model, is that you also have to know when to move on. You have to know, okay, I've prototyped enough here. And I used to have people ask me all the time, especially when you're talking about validate, so the test. So imagine we've gone through understand and we've spent time ideating, we've come up with ideas, now we've got some prototypes and we put them out there, and then we need to test those. And people used to come up to me all the time and say, well, how do I test? What do I do? I mean, is there a best practices? Is there a handbook for test? And the answer is, well, no, that's kind of your department. I can't tell you as a product developer, as a food product developer, how the IT guys test. It's not the same. I can't tell you as a building designer, as an architect, how the service, you know, models work when they're being tested. It's not the same. That's where your own expertise comes in and your own knowledge. And you, like I said, you have to hold it loosely and you have to go, okay, now we have to try this. And now we're done trying this. Now we have to do this. And so, not an equation. never an equation, but always held loosely with the understanding that if you want to get the best result, you follow the best process. And for me, design thinking has been and always will be the best process. Doing stuff around the house that requires my brain to check boxes to make sure I know what I'm talking about before I start making something. That's the way it goes.
Right, right. I love that. And I think you made a couple of points here. That being one is that you're making sure that you understand the problem that's being solved. You understand, you know, what you're talking about before you go making. You don't get stuck in any one particular spot. The other part is, I love what you say about holding loosely. You know, as you were talking about that, I'm also a martial arts guy and I've practiced Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do. And one of the things that Bruce Lee always used to say was there's a difference between having no form and having no form. And what he really means there is, if I had to rephrase that to communicate his meaning, there's a difference between being flexible and not having principles. You need to have principles, but you need to apply those principles and adapt to the situation. It's like Jeet Kune Do or any of the other martial arts that he did, it's not an equation. It's a system. It's a set of principles. And you apply it to the situation that you're in. It's not going to give you the specific answer every time. It's going to give you a way to create answers based on what you're dealing with. And that's what design thinking is to me. It's a system of thinking that you apply in a given situation. I don't consider it a straitjacket just because, again, when I encountered it, I just recognized it as the way that you make anything.
Yeah, well, that's the way we're made. I mean, we are living systems. And I tell my students all the time, design thinking is a living system. Unlike an equation, unlike something where you're putting in, you know, different variables, it's a living system. And when you think about the diverge and converge components of design thinking, when you go wide, when you go narrow, when you reach out, when you begin to analyze and really bring things in, our hearts work that way. Our lungs work that way. The universe works that way. We go wide, we go narrow. We flex out, we contract in. And so I always found that for me, the best, most useful thing about understanding design thinking was understanding where any of the people that I was talking to, any of the clients I was talking to, where they were in the process. And I use that diverge and converge in my mind mentally because I'm thinking, okay, are we ideating here or are we evaluating ideas? You know, we can't just say imagine. We're imagining. Well, okay, but are you gathering ideas or have you gathered enough and now you're evaluating which ones are the ones that you're going to chase? When you're prototyping, are you in low resolution where you're using all kinds of stuff? And, or are you bringing it in and you're going to high resolution definition? And people get off track a lot of times in design thinking. And I think the reason they get off track is because they forget they're supposed to be flaring and focusing. They're supposed to be a beating heart. It's supposed to be a living structure, a living system, a living process. And they put too much rigidity on it. I love your Bruce Lee quote. You know, it's too rigid right now. You need to have the principle. You need to be able to do this. You need to be able to flex. You need to be able to move here. And that's where I found most people got where they got tied up is because they didn't know when, at what point they should be doing this and what point they should be doing this. And I found that if I could do anything to help anybody, it was to add that filter on top of it, on top of their thinking, which really I thought helped me being a good consultant on that. Is to be able to point to them and say, no, you're not here, you're here. And here's why you're here and you haven't done this yet. So don't make the mistake of thinking you're farther along or further back than you may really be.
I love that. I love that. Man, this has been amazing. I do think that we've made some substantive examples and we've kind of outline these principles in a way that hopefully helps people make the distinction between thinking about design thinking as a restrictive, overly prescriptive set of processes as an equation that always is going to yield either a correct or an incorrect answer. You know, I love you talking about it in the sense of trying to find good, better, or best and being able to utilize design thinking to have a shot at finding the best answer.
Yeah, yeah. To me, design thinking is not the clay, it's the wheel.
Yeah, I love that. Man, it's the vehicle. It's the vehicle. Man, Steve, thank you so much for being on the show. Where can folks find you again? I know we said it last time, but for the folks that are listening to you for the first time, where can they find you?
They can find me on LinkedIn. I'm out there. I'm there. If people have questions, I'm happy to answer. If people need a design thinking person to kind of come alongside them and give them some counsel, that's part of what I do. So LinkedIn's best place to get me.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, folks, go and connect with Steve. Follow him on LinkedIn. He's a treasure trove of knowledge. And until next time, keep outserving your competition on your relentless pursuit to become an experienced leader. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, Devin.